Afternoon, everyone. Mr. Roland was talking about the trips to the grocery store that many of us will make tonight. I would bet that there were also probably a few pizza delivery guys that got a call last night shortly before sunset. I hope you enjoyed a relaxing evening on a double Sabbath. I'd like to start in 2 Timothy 2 today, 2 Timothy chapter 2, with one scripture. Second Timothy chapter 2 and verse 7, which says, "Consider what I say, and may the Lord give you understanding in all things." So here we have the principle that we are to consider the things that God teaches us. And to consider implies an act of pondering or an act of meditation, taking time to think more deeply about a subject and internalize it rather than just seeing it on the surface. Let's go also back to Isaiah 5. Isaiah 5, and there's a bit of a warning back here concerning the same subject. Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 12, which says, "The harp and the strings, the tambourine and flute and wine are in their feasts, but they do not regard the work of the Lord, nor consider the operation of his hands." Now, this verse contains a warning. Here the word feast refers more to a banquet or to a social occasion than a religious festival or a holy day, but the caution is still very relevant nonetheless. The people who were receiving this warning apparently had plenty of time for enjoying the good things and taking advantage of the blessings, but no time to think deeply about God's way of life and to understand what it really meant for them personally. So since we're at the end of the Feast of Unleavened Bread and we have a double Sabbath like we do, it seems like a very fitting time to pause and think for just a few moments about the feast we've just kept. We had time to enjoy one another's company, and we had time to rejoice in all of the blessings that God's holy days bring with them. But have we stopped to consider why we were doing what we were doing? So another way maybe to ask the question is, do we know why we did what we just did? Do we know why we did it? And again, with the feast having ended less than 24 hours ago, and us dovetailing straight into this Sabbath, it's a great time to spend a few minutes doing what you might call a debrief or a post-mortem on the things that we learned during the past week so that we can properly move toward the next holy day in the rehearsal of God's great plan of salvation. So as we begin to look forward to the Feast of Pentecost, let's review a few key lessons that we should be taking away from the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And choosing a way to do that, let's ask and answer three big questions about the meaning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. This isn't comprehensive by any means, but we'll look at three big questions about the Feast of Unleavened Bread and answer them and try to pull out some key lessons to carry forward with this. So the first big question is, why Egypt? Why Egypt? And in longer form, that question would be, why do we talk about Egypt so much during the days of unleavened bread? Well, part of the answer certainly has to do with the physical exodus of the nation of Israel from Egypt. But there's really a much deeper spiritual meaning connected to what Israel experienced in Egypt. Let's go back to Exodus 3, Exodus chapter 3, and review a part of the story, Exodus chapter 3, verse 7. Here it says, "And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows." Verse 9. "Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them." The Merriam-Webster Dictionary says that oppression is a sense of being weighed down in body or mind. And to oppress is to burden spiritually or mentally, to weigh heavily upon. So during their physical enslavement, the children of Israel certainly received the full measure of being burdened and weighed down. And there's a very graphic description of this in Leviticus 26, a few pages over, Leviticus 26. Verse 13, where it says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, that you should not be their slaves. I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you walk upright. So this verse paints the picture of a people who are so impacted by the day-in, day-out weight of their burdens that they couldn't even stand up straight. It's a picture we can very easily visualize. And that also sounds a lot like the way that we feel when we are impacted by sin, doesn't it? The formula for this cause and effect relationship is very simple, even though often we try to convince ourselves that it's not. You push a button, you get what you ordered. The result of sin is oppression. And again, we can even feel that within ourselves physically, right? When we're struggling with a sin and it feels like we are weighed down spiritually and mentally. The Bible has much to say about this. Again, what is a cause and effect relationship? For example, Isaiah 54:14 says, in righteousness you shall be established, you shall be far from oppression. Well, if righteousness causes you to be far from oppression, and oppression is caused by sin, then sin and oppression live in the same neighborhood, don't they? Where you find one, you find the other. Jesus Christ himself made the same connection in a warning to be watchful at the end of the age. Let's go to Luke 21. Luke 21. Luke chapter 21. We'll just read verse 34, where it says, but take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. Now the Greek word baruno here that is translated weighed down can also be translated to burden. And clearly Christ was saying that drunkenness and carousing, behavior that elsewhere is described clearly as sin in the Bible, those things bring oppression into the lives of the people who practice them. Jesus also understood the connection between sin and oppression on a much more personal level because of what he did for us in suffering on our behalf. Let's go to Isaiah 53, Isaiah chapter 53. We read this during the Passover. It talks about the suffering servant who was Christ. And in Isaiah 53:7, it says, he was oppressed and he was afflicted. So again, he was oppressed and afflicted as a result of the sins of humanity. And since he lived a perfect and sinless life, he deserved none of the treatment that he ultimately got. He, by default, was suffering because of sin, because of the sins that people were committing toward him. So even when our lives are impacted by the sins of others rather than our own sin, the result, very consistently, is still oppression. And the Apostle Peter confirms that in 2 Peter 2:7. You don't have to turn there. But in that verse, he says that Lot, even though he himself was righteous, it says he was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. So, again, to ask the question, why do we talk about Egypt so much during the days of unleavened bread? Well, it's not because we have anything against Egypt or Egyptians, per se. But in the biblical context of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Egypt represents the oppression that Israel experienced while they were there, which is the same oppression that we experience when sin is a part of our life. So Egypt equals oppression, and oppression equals sin. And the spiritual exodus that we are to focus on then is exactly what we practice during the days of Unleavened Bread, putting sin, represented by leaven, out of our lives. Putting sin out of our lives is an exodus from spiritual bondage and spiritual oppression into the freedom of righteousness. And we are told exactly that in the instruction to keep the feast and to teach our children about it. Let's go to Exodus 13 to review that. Exodus 13. Exodus 13, verses 7 and 8, which say, "Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, 'This is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from out of Egypt.'" So even when we talk among us ourselves and teach our children about these days, I would suggest that we do exactly what verse 8 does and make it very personal. "This is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt, when I came out of spiritual bondage and the spiritual oppression of sin." So the second question we'll look at then is, why leaven? Why leaven? Have you ever wondered why it's leaven that God tells us to put out? As with so many biblical requirements, our modern society would generally tell us that the removal of leaven is an arcane and very illogical relic of some, you know, former traditions that didn't really matter and didn't really make much sense. But like so many other things in the Bible, it makes tremendous sense when you understand what God wants to accomplish by giving us these requirements. The most common leaven agents like yeast and baking powder are, of course, used in breads and other baked goods, cookies and crackers and pie crust, etc. And you can basically place all the foods that use leavening into a large category of items that crumble up and make a big mess when you eat them. And you see that much more, of course, when you have kids. But there is a huge variety of food that we consume, right? There's fruits and vegetables and meats and dairy products, along with other forms of grain-based products. So why didn't God choose to have us put meat out of our diets instead of leaven? Why isn't it the Feast of Unconsumed Vegetables? All of our kids would like that, right? But we can begin to understand the answer by thinking about the purpose of this feast and what God is teaching us about putting sin out of our lives. With the sacrifice of Christ at the Passover, we're redeemed and cleansed, and the ultimate penalty of final death that we deserve for our sins is canceled out because of what he did for us, because he paid that penalty in full. So then, having been washed and clean, the days of unleavened bread are about going on to the new life that Mr. Swaggerty talked about yesterday. And we are to move forward with the process of completely replacing the old man that we were with the new man of having Christ live his life over within us. So if you were God, how would you have us picture that process and rehearse it in a tangible way every year that we can grasp? Well, one way would be exactly what we do, to have us completely put something out of our lives and to replace it with something else. We put out the leaven, we bring in the unleavened bread. Now, if the feast needs to be centered on a physical, tangible object lesson, we need an object, right, that lends itself to illustrating the lessons that we need to learn. So again, just imagine that we don't know what we don't know today. What kind of object would you pick to illustrate all those lessons? Well, if repetition is the key to learning, we know that it is, then, of course, food seems to fit that bill, right? We eat multiple times a day, every day, like clockwork. One way or another, we're going to usually get our 3 square meals. So then if you're going to use food, what type of food would you use to accurately represent the properties of sin and what it takes to put it out of our lives? Let's just think about a few of the properties of sin for a minute. First of all, sin pervades the world. It's something that we struggle with day in and day out, every single day. So a food to represent that would have to be a common dietary staple that we often eat every single day, right? Another property of sin, as Mr. Swaggerty explained yesterday, it's impossible to completely remove from our actions and character. So any food that represents it would need to be difficult to remove from our diet and from our property. Another property of sin is that the motives and actions that we have, the sinful motives and actions, are often very difficult to distinguish from right motives and actions. It's often very challenging to tell with our thoughts and actions, especially when you only see a little piece of the story, whether it represents sin or not. So any food that we would use to represent it would need to be confusable with some other similar foods. And then finally, from the perspective of a sinner, the act of committing sin is ultimately about self, isn't it? The very core motive of every sin is self-gratification. And in terms of character traits, pride is the word that we use to describe being too focused on self or excessively focused on yourself. So the food that gets put out would need to somehow illustrate the presence of pride, and the food that replaces it would need to somehow illustrate the absence of pride. So to summarize, if we were going to use a food for these object lessons, we need a food that we eat often, can't get rid of very easily, can confuse with some other similar foods, and one that can illustrate the properties of pride. So given all of those requirements, leavened and unleavened bread are really the only foods that could facilitate all of those object lessons we need to learn. And the key ingredient of bread and the ingredient that separates it from other similar products, like the unleavened bread that we eat, is leaven. So that's why we have to put it out. Very simply, leaven is the operative ingredient of the types of food that accurately represent the properties of sin. So back to the question I asked earlier, let's just imagine for a moment that God had chosen to have us put out something else, like meat. So if it were meat that we were supposed to put out for 7 days, first of all, unlike bread, meat has not been a common dietary staple throughout much of history. The period that we live in, where we often have it 2 or 3 times a day, is very uncommon in the rest of world history, right? So it would not provide a very good picture of sin's pervasiveness. Also, if we were commanded to remove meat from our home and property, most of us could probably do that in 5 to 10 minutes, right? There's one drawer in the refrigerator and one in the freezer maybe, and most of us, at least I hope, don't have meat lying around under our couch cushions or under the seats in the car, right? Also, meat, in all but a very few cases, is readily identifiable as meat. Now, even with all of the funny middle school jokes about mystery meat in the cafeteria lunch line, you can usually tell that meat is meat. It's not easily confusable with anything else. And it's also hard to imagine any description of meat that would cause us to be able to use it to illustrate the presence or absence of pride. So when we understand what God is trying to accomplish with the object lessons he provides and the alternatives to the instructions he gives us, his requirements really make perfect sense, don't they? So when we take the understanding that God has very mercifully revealed to us about what these days mean and take time to really consider the deeper meaning, we can see that God has really chosen precisely the right object to facilitate the right lessons that we need to learn in our journey of becoming more like him. So the third question then is, why do we have to clean? Why do we have to clean? This is a fairly self-explanatory question. And once again, our modern society takes a very skeptical view of religious rituals in general, let alone something as odd and out of the ordinary as de-leavening your home and your cars. And if you've ever explained this process in any detail to one of your friends at school or at work, they may listen politely, but they usually have that look on their face that they're wondering whether they need to call the funny farm, right, and get the men in white jackets out to pick you up. But again, when we consider more deeply what we've been asked to do, we see that God's way is full of both logic and common sense. and that this feast teaches very deep spiritual lessons through very simple object lessons that we carry out each year and that are easy to repeat and easy to understand. So the punchline of considering why we do what we do at this feast is that while we're working up a sweat trying to get out that leaven, we should be learning about the kinds of sins that we should be examining our hearts and minds for, to identify and then to put out spiritually. Now, as we should always be careful to remember, and I think it's already been mentioned several times, the physical de-leavening is not the most important part of the feast. Now, it is important to obey the physical command and to learn the object lessons that it demonstrates. But we always have to remember that de-leavening physically is not the highest priority. As with so many other things in God's way of life, the key to approaching it correctly is balance, right? Approaching it in a balanced way. So if you throw the last loaf of bread in the trash can and you don't do anything else, there are some important lessons that you'll miss out on by doing that. But if you go to the other extreme and rip out the baseboards and take the seats out of the car and things like that, there's a different but very real set of spiritual dangers that you can get into that way. So as Mr. Swaggerty pointed out yesterday, one of the key lessons to rehearse every year is that, as he explained, just as you can't unleaven a loaf of bread, you also can't fully de-leaven spiritually a human being. Our physical de-leavening should remind us of this every year, because if we're paying attention as you clean, you can't escape the very obvious lesson that you can't get every last crumb. So a good rule of thumb to ensure a balanced approach to the physical de-leavening is that we should avoid spending excessive amounts of time pursuing every last single crumb, but we should spend enough time and effort to really understand that you can't get every last crumb. So let's just spend a few minutes considering a few of the different types of leavening that you might have encountered before or during the feast of unleavened bread, and think about what spiritual lessons we could learn from each type. So I have a name for each one. So let's look first at the pre-feast cleaning. So first is the jackpot. Now, these are the loaves of bread in the pantry or the freezer or the cracker shelf in the kitchen cabinets. You know right where they are, just like we generally know where our biggest spiritual weaknesses are, right? Most of us know ourselves well enough to understand what our big weaknesses are. So both physically and spiritually, we can identify these things very easily and get straight to work on cleaning them up. Next comes the grunts. The grunts are the crumbs under the couch cushions, or the half a slice of toast that your kids slid right under the refrigerator 2 days before you started cleaning. And like some other spiritual issues in our lives, you still know right where these things are, you know that they're there, but it takes more effort to try to get them out. And in this category, some physical and spiritual grunt work is required to remove those things. Next, we have the sleeper cells. Now, this is the can of baking soda that's hidden in a corner of the pantry that's kind of unusual. You put it back one day somewhere different than it normally goes and kind of forgot about it a few months ago. Or it's the box of saltine crackers that someone else in the church shares with you right before the days of unleavened bread because you have kids, and you invariably set these kinds of things down in the garage and you forget about them, and then you find them during the feast, right? Now, the spiritual lesson in these kinds of things is, of course, that we all have secret sins, as King David referred to them. There are things that we need to change that we don't know that we need to change yet, and won't know until God reveals them to us. The next category, then, is the teasers. And these are the obvious crumbs that are just far enough inside of some permanent fixture that you can see them, but the vacuum won't suck them out, right? So there's pretty much nothing you can do. And the analogy for these frustrating little guys is that there are some sins which are so deeply lodged in our character that we cannot remove them without spiritual intervention, without, as Mr. Swaggerty said yesterday, tearing down the house and replacing it with a different one. And then finally, in cleaning for the feast, you might have encountered the decoys. The decoys. Now, these are the pieces of popcorn or styrofoam or whatever it is that looks like a crumb at first glance, but on closer inspection, it's not. It's something that's actually harmless. And the lesson here, of course, is that sin is not always easy to identify. The bad guys do not always wear black. And very often we need God to provide us with help and spiritual discernment so that we can understand the difference between things that are right and things that are wrong, so that we can see them and understand them and begin to work on removing them and putting them out of our lives. So those are things that you might have encountered before the feast. There's two things you might have encountered during the feast. First is the infiltrators. The infiltrators. Now, these are the wheat thins that you would bet your life are de-leavened by looking at the picture on the box, but ultimately they're not, right? And that's the kind of thing that you usually learn from reading the box while you're eating them during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So these are basically the inverse of the decoys. The inverse of the decoys. So instead of thinking it's leaven when it's not, you think it's unleavened and it's not. But the spiritual lesson is the same. We must have God's help to discern between good and evil, right and wrong, sin and righteousness. And then finally, during the feast, either in the past or this year, you might have encountered the gotchas. And these are the donuts or the cheeseburgers that you find yourself happily eating right during the middle of the feast. And the parents of one of Mandy's childhood friends have a very humorous stories about how one year after Fred was ordained as a deacon on the first day of Unleavened Bread, he went to lunch with some friends from church later that week and ordered a cheeseburger and proceeded to start to eat it before realizing his error. And we've all done things like that. The spiritual lesson in these incidents is, of course, that it's so very easy to find ourselves in the midst of sin, even sins that we are specifically trying to put out. And we've probably all experienced this. Even throughout the year, if there's a sin that you're working on trying to overcome, even if you're actively trying to put it out, it's so easy to find yourself right in the middle of it yet again. So again, the question, why do we have to clean? The simple answer is that if we pay attention while we are doing it, there are some very powerful spiritual lessons that we learn from the simple act of trying to remove leaven from our homes. And far from being an outdated and illogical requirement of some dark ages past, the process of de-leavening is really filled with straightforward and very common sense lessons about both our physical and spiritual lives. So in conclusion, brethren, let's be diligent to remember some of the key lessons that we've reviewed from the Feast of Unleavened Bread that we've just kept as we're now moving toward the Feast of Pentecost. Through the three questions that we've asked and answered, we've seen that this Feast of God is very meaningful and very logical, and that its object lessons teach an understanding that is extremely important for our spiritual and physical well-being. So while many would see the requirements of this feast as unnecessary and maybe even harmful as a burden in our lives, we should see them as an incredible blessing for the understanding that they provide for us. And there's one verse in the book of Galatians that I think is an excellent summary of the attitude that we should have after having observed this wonderful feast. Now, in context, this verse is written in a chapter where Paul is addressing some questions about the issue of circumcision. But what he says is also a very general principle that applies to many, many aspects of God's way of life. So as we think about what we've learned from this Feast of Unleavened Bread, let's remember what Paul said in Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 1. where he says, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again in a yoke of bondage." The requirements of this feast are not bondage. They are the keys of coming out of bondage and remaining truly free.